today on Against the Grain. What happens when a school, a public school, establishes a program and a curriculum in homeland security? What messages are then conveyed to students about national security, terrorism, militarism, and surveillance? I'm CS. Nicole Wynn joins me to discuss her book, A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. I'm old enough, and perhaps so are you, to know when I'm told by someone that militarism is the path, the only path toward security, that guns and gun use ought to be celebrated, that fear should guide our actions. I'm old enough and informed enough to know that these claims should be questioned, should be investigated, should be countered by other opinions and facts. But what if you're young? What if you're, say, 15 or 16 years old, and you're told these things? Not only told, but taught these things in school, not just by teachers, but also by government officials and executives of companies you hope to eventually work for. Nicole Wynn, a professor at the University of Illinois at Chicago, did deep ethnographic work at a school, a high school in the U.S. that has a homeland security program, in which students enroll in courses on threats to national security, emergency response, and a range of other topics. What Nicole discovered about what the students are being taught and the attitudes and beliefs they are encouraged to adopt is laid out in her book, A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. When Nicole Wynn joined me, I asked her about the size of Milton High School and the community in which it's located.
Milton High School serves about 2,000 students. About 80% of the students were students of color. Some of the students come from poor working class backgrounds. And the school was in a community that was rapidly changing. So in the 70s, this was a white working class community. And then you had the gentrification of DC and Baltimore. And so with that gentrification, you had poor and working class families of color who were being pushed out of city centers and into nearby suburbs. And where Milton High School was located was one of those suburbs that was receiving families that were being pushed out of city centers. So in the late 90s, the demographics began quickly shifting. And so you went from a white working class population to a population of color that was also poor and working class. So you had three public housing units go up during this time. And so with those changing demographics came the changing demographics of Milton High School. And that's when you saw a shift from a white working class student population to a population that was predominantly youth of color. About 6% of the students were unhoused, 30% of students qualified for free and reduced lunch, and 30% of students actually came from military families from a nearby military base. So the demographics were, it was a very diverse school, and it was that diversity was relatively new to this school. So the school is really scrambling to figure out, well, how do we make sense of these shifting demographics, and how do we alter our curriculum to meet the needs of these new students who are at our school?
And the breakdown in terms of African Americans and Latinos and other people of color, students of color in the school?
So I don't have the exact breakdown. The school didn't break down their demographics in that way. It was just students of color and white students. But the students of color were primarily Black and Latinx, mostly Black students, in fact. So a large portion of that 80% would be Black students.
How did Milton High School come to have a homeland security program?
Milton High School had, with these shifting demographics, Milton High School had a somewhat notorious reputation as a poor performing, low performing, rough and rowdy school. Those were the vocabularies used by Milton teachers. So in the 90s, when an increasing number of students of color began attending Milton High School, the public saw the school as dangerous and just not a good school. And so the school throughout the 90s went through a variety of school reform plans. One of those was to create a series of career opportunities for young people. So they created career academies. So each academy was themed. You had, engineering, arts, humanities, and the idea was that those smaller learning communities would create a sense of belonging within an otherwise large and impersonal school while preparing kids for future jobs. And that was really the seed for the Homeland Security program. It was the school demographics are shifting very rapidly. We don't quite know how to meet the needs of our students. The school has a notorious reputation as a bad school, and there's a chance that an increasing number of national security families, high-level national security families, will move to this greater DC area to assume national security jobs as the industry continues to grow in the area. And so, taking that seed of that initial school reform project to align school curricula with future jobs, the high school said, look, there's a national security industry, the national security industry in the region, it's booming, there's a lot of excitement and interest around national security. Couldn't this be a hook to get kids interested in school, to get kids engaged in school? So it was about getting students who are already at the school engaged through a national security theme, but it was also about attracting middle and upper class families to the region. So families who might relocate to assume jobs had to choose a neighborhood to live in. And Milton at the time was hoping that this exciting new program would attract these families to live in the neighborhood, to buy homes in the neighborhood. Well, it turned out that most of these middle and upper class families didn't move to the Milton area. They moved to whiter suburbs in the region. And so the school decided, well, we need to create some kind of program for the students who are struggling at our school, who need a little bit of a boost in order to graduate from high school and obtain blue collar jobs. And so the larger district wanted to create a themed program of study at each of its high schools. And so this was called the Trademark Initiative. So Milton High School's trademark, its signature program, would be the Homeland Security program. And the idea was that local businesses could support this school reform effort by providing resources, providing curriculum development with teachers, providing internship opportunities, and also carving out pathways for young people to obtain jobs after graduation. So it was a sort of a twofold process of improving the school, improving the reputation of the school, as well as feeding the national security industry this pipeline of skilled workers.
Is there anything official about this? I mean, does the Department of Homeland Security give certifications such that schools can have a Homeland Security program?
So it's not ordained by the Department of Homeland Security in the sense that students walk out with some kind of Homeland Security certificate, but there are certifications in place that really incentivize young people from joining these programs. So one of those is a GIS certification. It's an industry recognized certification that communicates that students know something about GIS technology, so map making technology that can be used to obtain entry level jobs in the national security industry, but also within the sort of technology industry writ large. So the Department of Homeland Security's hand in this is providing funding through grants, funding through various resources for field trips, for internships, as well as providing national security experts to serve as guest speakers or as mentors.
So, what proportion of students at this high school enroll in the Homeland Security program at the school, and what's the gender balance?
So of the 2,000 students, I would say there were about 120 students who were enrolled in the Homeland Security program. There was certainly more interest, but there was, of course, funding issues with providing, so many teachers for a program that was considered an elective program. So the gender balance was actually about 50-50, and this was an intentional effort on the part of the first Homeland Security teacher, who is a black woman, and she wanted to ensure that girls, especially girls of color, were involved from the very beginning in the program. And so those early efforts created an initial gender balance that continued over the years.
So the curriculum that is taught to students who participate in the Homeland Security program at this school, was it developed outside and brought into the school, or did the teachers and staff at this high school come up with it?
It's a mixture of both. So Milton High School modeled its program after another high school that installed a similar Homeland Security and Emergency Management program. So there was some architecture or outline for the curriculum, but Milton teachers and administrators really spearheaded the curriculum development themselves. So they went out and met with national security experts throughout the community. They met with Northrop Grumman officials, Lockheed Martin officials, people from the National Security Agency, from DHS. They attended conferences. And so it was really a school-led effort to develop a curriculum specific to Milton High School. So a curriculum that was specific to the resources that were available within the larger community and also specific to its student body. What I mean by this is Milton's Homeland Security program had an explicitly military focus. And if you asked a teacher about a nearby school that was developing its own Homeland Security program, teachers would say, well, that program is going to have this engineering focus because that's a whiter, more middle class school. And so that better suits the needs of those students. And so this was certainly teacher-led, teacher-driven school reform at its core.
And of course, Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman are among the top-tier defense contractors in the U.S. In fact, I read that in October 2015, Northrop Grumman was awarded a $21.4 billion Pentagon contract to build the next generation long-range strike bomber. It was the biggest contract out of the Pentagon in more than 10 years. Getting back to the nuts and bolts of this curriculum and this program, in the first 2 years of high school, what did the Milton High School students who participated in this program, what kinds of courses did they take?
So there were two specific courses for first and second year students in the program. And those courses were called the Foundations of Homeland Security 1 and the Foundations of Homeland Security 2. And Homeland Security 1 was a course that was really an introduction for students to issues of national security. So they were studying national security threats like agro-terrorism, so terrorism against agriculture, looking at issues of cybersecurity, identity theft, all the various forms of terrorism that students might not have learned before. And so they're doing a very specific study of those national security threats. And then Homeland Security 2 was taking those national security threats they learned their first year and then thinking about, well, how do federal, state, local, and private organizations respond to those threats? So that course was mainly focused on emergency management, response, and recovery. So it's sort of applying emergency management to these national security threats. And part of this curriculum is about practicing responding to national security threats, preparing for and planning for specific national security threats through classroom learning, but also through field trips, guest speakers, hands-on learning, and things like that.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Nicole Nguyen joins us. Her last name is spelled Nguyen. She teaches in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Her research focuses on the intersections of national security, war, and U.S. public schooling. And she's the author of the book, A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools, which examines a U.S. high school's homeland security program, what it means to students and staff and teachers and community, and what it says about the militarization and what she calls the securitization of public schools in this country. So after completing this two-year course sequence in their freshman and sophomore years, again, the first year focusing mainly on threats to national security, the second year focusing on emergency management and response, what then happens to the students in their junior and senior years?
So after completing the Homeland Security 1 and 2 classes, students could then choose what Milton called a career channel. So this was choosing another elective that would prepare them specifically for a job within the national security industry. So at the time of my fieldwork, there were three specific career channels. GIS, Geographic Information System, so that's learning how to make maps using computers, criminal justice, and science and engineering. And at the time of my research, it was GIS was actually the only truly developed program of study that students entered into as an elective. And Milton was also developing two additional career channels, one that officially launched, which was National Security Intelligence. And then the second one that's planned is called Securing Critical Infrastructures. And so again, the intention behind these career channels is that students would get a more intensive hands-on study of the skills and training needed for a future job within the national security industry.
Did the non-Homeland Security program teachers at this high school, were they required to teach Homeland Security-related topics?
The school district itself had, so when schools adopted a trademark into their school, so Milton chose Homeland Security, other schools chose trademarks like Global Leadership or Engineering, the idea was that that theme would permeate the entire school. So when Milton chose the Homeland Security theme, the idea behind that was that the school's identity would be organized around Homeland Security. And a part of that was getting teachers who are math teachers or science teachers or social studies teachers to incorporate the Homeland Security theme into their classroom. So it wasn't necessarily a requirement, but it was strongly encouraged. And I saw lots of different examples of that. You know, an algebra teacher taught her students parabolas using the example of a sniper is trying to shoot a target in North Korea, so they had to calculate the parabolic force needed to find and shoot that target in North Korea. In English class, students read Romeo and Juliet and began thinking about how being banished from a town could expose you to, you know, biological or chemical warfare. So thinking about the plague and those national security terms. So teachers weren't necessarily required to incorporate the theme, and not all teachers did, but there were certainly teachers who spearheaded initiatives to ensure that Homeland Security theme permeated really all aspects of everyday life at the school.
Students also participated in so-called supplements. What are supplements?
So supplements were additional activities students participated in as a part of their everyday learning in the Homeland Security program. And this took three main forms. The first was guest lectures. So you had high-level NSA agents or FBI agents come to the school and give guest talks about the pressing national security threats the U.S. faced and how their work within their agencies thwarted those threats. The second was going on field trips, so students went to places like a local college's cyber battle lab, they went to the Naval Academy, they took a trip to commemorate September 11th to New York City where they toured the World Trade Centers, they went to the Crime and Punishment Museum. So essentially all these field trips were organized around extended learning about national security, whether that was where national security agents work or historical national security sites like going to New York City. And then the third supplement was internships. So students secured internships at places like the NSA where they earned security clearances and spent a summer interning for the NSA.
So a lot of this book is about the messages that are given to, are conveyed to students sitting in these classes, in these Homeland Security Program classes in this high school, and how the students reacted to them, what beliefs and attitudes were fostered in the students as they thought about these many issues. Let's start with one theme that comes out pretty strongly in your book, which is this notion of vulnerability, of the U.S. as vulnerable to threats. To what extent was that image promoted and encouraged in terms of students' attitudes?
I think the U.S. as vulnerable was a key organizing theme within the curriculum. So everything students studied always came back to the fact that the U.S. was vulnerable. And Mr. Vitale, who's a high-level NSA agent, when he gave a guest talk, he actually asked students what it meant to be vulnerable. And he had students define vulnerable because he wanted to emphasize that the U.S. was extraordinarily vulnerable to an unknown number of threats every single day. And he was talking specifically about cybersecurity. And when we're talking about U.S. vulnerability to a terrorist attack, at the school it was always contextualized by September 11th. So almost every guest speaker I observed used their own experiences responding to or existing during a time of September 11th as a way to organize their talk. So Sandra Day, who is a high-level Department of Homeland Security agent, she came to talk about the work of the Department of Homeland Security, and she began with a narrative about Special Agent John O'Neill and his efforts during September 11th. He was somebody who died during September 11th. You heard from U.S. Army Corps of Engineers who spoke about their search and rescue efforts following September 11th. So most of these guest speakers open their talks with reference to September 11th, either through stories or images of the burning Twin Towers, as a way to really locate national security efforts, that this was always a reminder of what could be lost again, what was lost and what could be lost. And this is to a generation of students who were very young when September 11th happened, so have no firsthand memory of September 11th, and so they're learning about September 11th and its meaning through these national security experts. And so that was a way of showing just how vulnerable the U.S. was. It was the sense that the U.S. was always vulnerable to another September 11th. That was the common refrain that circulated at the school, and so it was really this sense of vulnerability that sort of justified everything else that happened in the Homeland Security program, as well as the kind of tactics the U.S. engaged in. So military engagements, war, surveillance, spying, all of these things were justified in order to protect an utterly vulnerable nation like the United States.
I see. So vulnerability was presented as a kind of fact of existence of living in the U.S., but it was also used to justify a way of responding, a way of trying to protect the nation in the face of all these vulnerabilities?
Yes. So everything was staged as a defense mechanism. So the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, all of that was in response to September 11th. So this was, again, about protecting a very vulnerable nation. And so this was a way of organizing what students were learning. Students were learning that essentially that war and violence were justified because of this deeply vulnerable state that the U.S. was in. And so there was never a time where military aggression appeared to be excessive or that there were other kinds of responses necessary in order to protect the U.S. I guess what I'm saying is that vulnerability becomes a way of thinking about the United States such that war is the only response, war is the only answer. And so it's a particular kind of vulnerability that was framed in a way that young people saw war as not only necessary, but good.
But of course, there are alternatives to military, quote, solutions to these issues. Are you saying that these alternatives were rarely or never discussed or debated in the classroom?
Yeah, so I would say that non-military solutions were very rarely discussed in the class. And part of this was because, so if we take an example from Mr. Vitale from the National Security Agency, so he was very intent on saying the U.S. was vulnerable to a cyber attack. The U.S. was so vulnerable that we didn't even know how many vulnerabilities there were. And so he likened this to the Empire State Building. And he said, cybersecurity threats are like the Empire State Building, where every window and door is a potential threat. And we don't know what all the threats are because we don't know how many windows and doors there are. And so he said, given this, you know, national security context, if you attempt to calculate your risk through this risk formula that he gave, so there's a way of calculating risk, this idea that you can objectively measure risk, then you can apply some kind of countermeasure to thwart that risk or to reduce that risk. And so when you present a formula, so his formula was threat plus vulnerability equals risk. And once you calculate risk, you can then calculate what he called an appropriate countermeasure. So the way that this is presented, it sounds like we're conducting some kind of mathematical assessments that then gives us some kind of objective response to risk. So if there's this national security risk, and Mr. Vitale says he's conducted a risk assessment, and, you know, going to war with Afghanistan is an appropriate countermeasure, then in students' minds, that then becomes justified. So there are all these strategies that guest speakers use, as well as teachers use, to say, look, war is justified because we've done our calculations, we've done our threat assessment, we've calculated what needs to be calculated, and the numbers show us that this is how we make ourselves secure. And so by framing it in this way, students aren't thinking about anything other than the countermeasures that are offered by guest speakers or teachers. And that was always about increased surveillance, increased spying, military aggression, or war. So part of what the program did, and I don't think it was intentional on the part of teachers, but it's a result of the curriculum, is really foreclose not only what counted as national security or national insecurity, but what also counted as these appropriate countermeasures to thwart national security risks. And so that was a core part of what the program was trying to accomplish, was these are the things that make you insecure. Not gentrification, not poverty, not racism, not police brutality, but these, you know, unknown, unseeable national security threats. And the things that make you secure are only military aggression, war, or surveillance, or spying.
Nicole Nguyen is her name. Her book is A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. She is Assistant Professor of Social Foundations of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We'll take a short break and speak more with Nicole about her eye-opening book. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Nicole Nguyen joins us, and her book is A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press, and it again examines a U.S. high school's specialized homeland security program. So, Nicole, if you have these guest speakers coming in, whether from national security industry or, you know, national security-related agencies of the federal or state government, and they're talking about the intense vulnerability of the U.S., and they're talking about terrorist attacks. And so if we take the figure of the, quote, terrorist, you might expect that the students are taught about who these terrorists are and what their motivations are for doing these things. To what extent was that covered and addressed?
Teachers would say that an explicit part of the program was addressing why terrorists do terroristic things. This was not actually something I observed. A lot of times this was presented in sort of a reductionist view of terrorism, that, you know, terrorists are evil, they're evildoers, sort of echoing George Bush's language following September 11th, that these are evil people. And so there wasn't, I didn't observe any explicit exploration of why terrorists commit acts of terrorism. And I'm thinking specifically about a person from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers came to talk about, he was deployed in 2005 to Afghanistan. And one of the things that he was doing was giving students an introduction to what life is like in Afghanistan, because for most of the young people, they had never seen images of Afghanistan or had really never heard of Afghanistan before. I think their teacher, their actual Homeland Security teacher's question about this was the Disney film Aladdin. Did that take place in Afghanistan? So that's actually their frame of reference. That's what they know about Afghanistan, is there's this Disney movie that might have taken place in a country like Afghanistan. And so part of what this guest speaker was saying was, you know, Afghan children, they don't know how to read or write, they don't use electricity, they play in the trash. And so it was this idea of what the guest speaker said was that Afghanistan was back in the Stone Ages and 1,000 years behind the United States in terms of development. And so you create this image of a backwards, sort of lawless nation. He showed photos of a billboard in Arabic that he said translated to "every Afghan carries an AK-47. So you create this image of a country that that young people have no knowledge of and have no experience with, and you sort of render this backwards, dangerous, lawless breeding ground for terrorists. And there's no explanation needed to examine why terrorists do what they do, because it's the story already plays itself out. The tropes are already available for students. So terrorists do what they do because, you know, they're evil or they're bad people or they don't have morals or they're Muslim or they're brown or they're from Afghanistan. And so I never witnessed the exploration of why terrorists do what they do. And in the absence of that discussion, I saw this rendering of the Middle East as inherently violent, as inherently terroristic, as inherently just backwards. And so students were filling in the blanks with those kinds of narratives. They were also filling in the blanks with video game references. So they were using what they learned in things like Call of Duty or Modern Warfare as a way of making sense of a terrorist. And so when the Boston Marathon bombings happened while I was at the school, students had all these narratives about Russians and Chechens, and all of that came from video games. And so without the explicit discussion of why terrorism exists and what terrorists are, what the political and social and economic grievances are of people who commit acts of terrorism, that young people were able to sort of fill in these gaps with other narratives that were either circulating in the talks of guest speakers, in pop culture, pop media, as well as video games.
Yeah, I mean, not bringing up the social grievances, the economic grievances of people who do some of these acts, that's pretty weird to me, because if you are going to talk about preventing these actions from taking place, you would imagine that there would be some kind of emphasis or focus on what is driving these people to do these things and how might we address these economic or social or political factors.
I agree, but I think their sense of protection and prevention were really about what kind of measures can the United States take. So it wasn't sort of what kind of deals can we broker or how can we address political or economic grievances. It's sort of how can we fortress the nation? So how can we, you know, make it so terrorists can't hack our water supply or attack our water supply? How can we protect our agriculture? So it's that sort of protectionist, militarized protectionist response to terrorism. It's not addressing terrorism or quote unquote terrorism at its roots. And so I think that allows for not addressing the root causes of terrorism, particularly in U.S. military aggression or colonialism, allows for a different kind of response. And so I think in order for the school to advance this dominant national security narrative and to call young people to enact national security norms and doctrines and practices, you can actually explore those root causes. Because addressing those root causes calls for something other than war, something other than military aggression. And the program and the national security experts weren't going to give up those investments and commitments to war and surveillance and spying and things like that.
So you said the focus of this particular Homeland Security program in this school, because as you said earlier, a number of other schools have Homeland Security programs. This is not just an isolated phenomenon. that the focus was on the military, militarization, militarism. And one way to get into this topic, I guess, is to talk about guns and weapons. What kinds of discussion of guns and other weapons did you observe in the classroom and on the field trips and the guest speaker talks? And what did that tell you about the nature of the security message being inculcated into these students?
You know, I'm from Pennsylvania, which is rich in gun culture, but I never grew up around guns. Guns just weren't around my house. It's not something we talked about. It's not something I ever experienced. And so to land in a school where guns, the more you knew about guns, the more sway you sort of had, I thought was really shocking to me, just because I wasn't familiar with that culture. So you had young people who wanted to were very eager to show off what they knew about guns. So there was somebody from the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and he was showing the different military technologies that were used to defend nuclear power plants from terrorist attacks. And as he was flipping through his PowerPoint presentation, he just had images of all of these different weapon systems, and students would stop him because they wanted to identify the weapon that was, or the gun that was in his PowerPoint presentation. And so it became a point of pride that young people knew what all of these weapon systems were, what all of these guns were. A student approached me one day and he said, we were going to the State Police Academy for a field trip, and he said, you know, I brought my gun license. Do you think we'll get to use some guns today? And so again, this was a culture I was not familiar with, where people were talking about guns, you know, like they were talking about their favorite soda. It was just a common point of discussion. I had sent one of the teachers, Ms. Perez, a clip of, I think it was bulletproof whiteboards or bulletproof school uniforms. So there was some company in Latin America that was creating bulletproof uniforms and book bags. And so I sent it to her because I thought, wow, this is really outrageous that we've come to this point in the United States where kids need to wear bulletproof uniforms and backpacks. And so the teacher showed this clip in her Homeland Security class. And instead of questioning the need for these bulletproof, you know, school products, it became a discussion. So in the video, a person is wearing the school uniform or school backpack, and he gets shot at point blank range, and has no reaction to show the protection of this product. And instead of like debating, you know, how outrageous it is to have bulletproof anything in school, students began talking about, is this video real? Is the gun real? Well, what kind of recoil would a gun have? And then the teacher is talking about, you know, here's how a shotgun works, and here's, you know, how the bullet passes through a shotgun, right? So all of a sudden, this conversation that I thought would be about questioning national security became re-emphasizing gun culture within the school. And then this was also, gun culture was sort of explicitly written into the curriculum. An example of that is we went to the State Police Academy, and we were running through this drill, essentially where students were pursuing three suspects in a home invasion. And so I participated. I was one of the suspects that they were pursuing. And then students were the police officers who were conducting this police training drill. And as a part of the drill, we were all given police training guns. So they're not actual guns. They're fake training guns, but they look and feel like guns. And they're the training guns that police use. And I remember like walking, holding the gun, thinking, this is really outrageous. But students, you know, held the gun. They knew how to hold the gun or pull it from, you know, holster. And they just had so much weaponry knowledge from their participation in the program, again, from video games. So again, this conversation around guns, having guns, knowing about guns, using guns, was really part and parcel to the program and to the culture of the program.
Nicole Nguyen is her name. Again, her last name is spelled Nguyen. She's assistant professor in the Department of Educational Policy Studies at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And she conducted a school ethnography during the 2012-2013 school year. And that ethnography has become a book. It's called A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. And the book focuses on one school that she observed with great regularity and intensity. She calls it Milton High School. All the names and locations have been changed because I take it because of academic research protocols. But this Milton High School had a homeland security program, a specialized homeland security program through which a proportion of its students who were often recruited in middle school and sometimes in elementary school were recruited to participate in. So you relate many of the practices and behaviors you've just described to a kind of masculinity that you saw at play, I mean literally at play sometimes, in the hallways and in the classrooms of this high school. Talk more about that.
So I would say there was a kind of militarized masculinity. So a masculinity that was tied to military knowledge, that was tied to guns, that was sort of this brawns over brains, protectionist, sort of paternalistic understanding of gender norms. And so boys were always quick to perform this kind of militarized masculinity. And so this could be expressed through gun knowledge, through gun culture. It was also expressed through objectifying girls in the classroom, so treating girls like sexual objects. It was also about enacting violence. So I was talking to a student, they were actually building, NASA had come in and they were helping students build rockets, functioning rockets. And while students were creating these rockets, one student called me over and he was asking me if I liked a book. And as I walked away, he formed the shape of a gun with his fingers and pointed it at his friend and said, "Pow," and the two of them started laughing. And then I walked over to another group and another male student was asking if NASA had a strip club. So again, all of these forms of sort of hyper-militarized masculinity came to the fore and were really celebrated. So the student who pretended to shoot his friend, you know, in any other school, that would be like a zero tolerance offense and the student could get, you know, suspended or expelled for that. And that was instead, you know, elicited giggles and the affirmation of his classmates. The student who continually asked if NASA had a strip club, again, you know, that was never disrupted by his teacher. It was never, he was never disciplined for it. And so there were all these ways that these deeply militarized kinds of masculinities were celebrated and valorized within the school. And again, that was really infused with associations with guns, with brute force. So students participated in an obstacle course at the police academy, and everyone was intent on winning, on having the fastest time in the obstacle course. Like, the boys were actively competing. And so some students were throwing up at the end, that they had run so hard after lunch that they were throwing up. But it was, again, about proving their masculinity in this deeply militarized way. It was about, you know, showing their muscles, their brute force, in a way that was deeply valorized, not only by the school, but also by national security agents who would grunt and, you know, have all these exclamations about how the U.S., you know, was the best nation. And it was, again, about brute force. So militarized masculinity certainly organized a lot of the logics that were at the school, and that militarized masculinity became something students wanted to perform and wanted to perform in a way that would get the attention and affirmation of their teachers.
What did it mean to you that these male students of Milton High School, who were encouraged to act in aggressive and masculinist ways, were mostly African American?
Yes, I think this is one of the most confounding parts of Milton. So you have Black boys who were encouraged to perform militarized masculinities. And so if we think about militarized masculinity as this sort of virile, hypersexual, aggressive, violent form of masculinity, we know that that maps onto these dominant racist tropes of the Black male body as inherently violent and hypersexual that needs to be controlled, policed, disciplined. And so the things that get the very forms of masculinity that the police pursue in the street, so the things that get boys in trouble for simply occupying a male body, is the thing that is then revalorized within Milton's Homeland Security program. And so students are sort of navigating this very tenuous situation where they're encouraged to be aggressive, they're encouraged to be hypersexual, they're encouraged to objectify girls. And in society, that's why you're policed and controlled, but then you're encouraged to do that so that you become quintessential military recruits. And so there's this sort of dialectic process of devalorizing the black male body by the police, but then this revalorization through military enlistment, and one hinges on the other. So the devaloration of the black male body allows for the military to then revalorize it. So there's something about putting a black body in a military uniform that somehow makes it less threatening, right? And this is, again, a racialized process of disciplining male bodies of color more generally. And so the program was able to sort of walk this fine line between devalorizing black masculinities or racist understandings of black masculinity, and then revalorizing the same type of black masculinity through military enlistment. And it was sort of a genius thing because people would call for, in the school, students would call for, you know, they would say, our school is unsafe, so we want more cameras, we want more police officers, we want more guns, we want more security technologies within the school because we feel unsafe. And then teachers would say, yes, we feel unsafe because our students are dangerous, so let's take the cameras and the police officers and the security measures that students are calling for and let's apply it to their bodies. So let's use the police technologies to police our own students. And so, again, it's a contradiction that's smoothed over, and it's not read as a contradiction, because students are made to feel safer, students are made to feel valued through their participation in the Homeland Security program, even though the things that they're learning in the Homeland Security program are the processes through which their neighborhoods and communities and bodies are rendered disposable, dangerous, and threatening. And so to enlist black boys into the military, you need to sort of devalue black boys. That's sort of the circuit that Milton was really able to work very effectively.
And this desire by the students to make their school safer was driven by fear, a fear stoked by what they were taught in terms of the vulnerability of the nation. And you can read much more about kind of the importance of fear and the political uses of fear in this school in my guest's book, A Curriculum of Fear, by Nicole Wynn. I want to ask you about your assertion that we must reconceptualize school militarization as school securitization. What does that mean?
So I think when a lot of times when we're talking generally about school militarization or militarization more broadly, we're talking about institutional arrangements with the formal military institution. So when we think about school militarization, we often think about GROTC, the Junior Reserve Officer Training Corps. We might think about military charter schools or military academies and public schools. But we're not talking about the role of national security agencies. So Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, these major defense contractors. We're not talking about the role of the Department of Homeland Security. So it's really taking militarization and saying it's about the military, but it's also about all of these other agencies that draw young people into closer proximity to war, that really infuse everyday life with national security norms, values, habits, beliefs, that are certainly tied to military aggression and to war, but not only to the military institution. There are all of these other institutions that contribute to aligning U.S. public schools and U.S. public society with a war agenda.
So you've indicated that there were a number of outside partners, entities that supported Milton High School's Homeland Security program, and they included defense contractors like Northrop Grumman and security corporations. Well, these are private corporations. To what extent does this collaboration between a public high school and private companies point toward the phenomenon of privatization and the impact privatization can have in this nation?
Sure. So I think as you sort of see the rollback in public funds, public investment in public education, you're going to see an increasing role not only of the military and of national security, of federal and state entities, but also these private organizations, private corporations, who are able to provide resources, they're able to provide funds and grants for public schools. So in part, Homeland Security programs are made possible by the rollback in funding for public education. So as funding for public education is withdrawn, public schools are now looking to other places to get funding, and the national security industry is one of the major funders of public schools, whether that's building computer labs, whether that's robotics programs, science and engineering programs, after-school programs. And so for me, Milton's Homeland Security Program would not be possible without this desire to collaborate with business partners. So part of it's about a funding issue, so schools seeking resources, but this is also connected to the shifting purpose of education. And we see this intensification of defining education as solely job training. So the draw of the Homeland Security Program was, we can get, and this is a quote from a teacher, blue-collar kids to get blue-collar jobs. So the primary thrust was, we need to get kids jobs. Like that's our role, that's our goal as a public institution, as a public school. And the national security industry not only provides resources, it also provides pathways for young people who are economically insecure to find to secure a financial future, particularly for kids of color and poor and working class youth, that a liberal arts education is no longer necessary or suitable for these groups of young people.
Do you see a trend toward more and more schools adopting Homeland Security programs?
I do see a trend. I get a few emails every month about a new Homeland Security program at a school. I also think that we need to be aware that these are not the only institutional arrangements with the national security industry. Right now I'm following these policies around countering violent extremism. So it's about calling on teachers and guidance counselors and social service providers to identify potential, foreign fighters. So if young people in the United States might join ISIS, it's the teacher's job to report those individuals to the FBI. So I think we're going to see the continued development of Homeland Security programs, but I also think the national security industry is going to continue to innovate how it is using public schools and the purpose of its relationship with public schools. And that's something to sort of keep an eye on.
Nicole Wynn, Assistant Professor of Social Foundations of Education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. We've been talking about her book, A Curriculum of Fear, Homeland Security in U.S. Public Schools. It's published by the University of Minnesota Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, as well as a link there to her faculty page at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Nicole, thanks for writing this book, and thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks so much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.